Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hello again, friends. That was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown. And this is the Voice of Vachon's Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show, radiating from the beehive of cultural awareness known formerly as the Gene Bosch Broadcast Studio, in the bustling and bodacious heart of our pastoral Vachon Island community. Together, we, the Brieflies, aspire to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy and always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less, and we always aim to deliver more. Let me introduce the Brieflies once again and our guests. Engineering the show from behind the big red button here in the JBBS is our intrepid retired Alaska Airline Captain, Vachon Airport Commissioner, and my fellow treetop flyer, Truman O'Brien.
I am here. Good morning.
Indeed you are. Thank you for being behind the big board. See if we can land this thing.
Good luck.
Rather than in the treetop.
Indeed.
Also present in the studio is part-time Politico, fairy fixer, executive director of Vachon Household, and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreher.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, Amy.
Yeah, I got to get some more shenanigans on. You that's do. What we were just talking about.
Yeah, too much business.
Slacking.
That's
you're
right.
Slacking.
I am. Yeah. I got a shenanigan.
There you go. I wasn't expecting a dad joke out of you.
Every time.
And she's got her dad shirt on.
That's right. Get closer to the mic so people can see that dad shirt. Yeah. Also present is historian, professor, down under aficionado, and now even more in demand than ever, our guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Holman.
Good to be here. I've decided I need to call up reinforcements for the Guardian of the Galaxy right now. We need more Guardians.
Oh, boy.
Indeed.
Do we ever. And zooming in from his boat, I think anchored somewhere in the South Sound, we'll find out in a second, is rower, backpacker, and how many more months of this administration is going to be around, inquirer Kevin Jones.
Hey, feeling bodacious here in Paulsbo, anchored off the Sons of Norway Hall, enjoying a beautiful fall morning in the Pacific Northwest.
That does sound bodacious.
It does.
You should. Two for two. She's got it.
I'm on.
Not supposed to do that.
I know. You pick up a pastry while you're over there by Paulsbo.
There you go.
We were in the bakery this morning. I've got the sourdough bread. You know, we're going strong.
Oh, right. you're with the program. All right, joining us today is Alex Bruel, who will give us a behind-the-scenes look at what it was like being the editor of the Vachon Maury Island Beachcomber, as well as his impressions of Vachon, the nation, and the world from that unique perspective. How you doing, Alex?
I'm doing well. I didn't know I'd be giving world perspectives.
I warned you that sometimes we go a little off script. We may not go to the world. So
we can go to the solar system or the galaxy. Yeah. If you want.
There you go.
And beyond.
And beyond.
We'll go
as long as you want.
And I'm I'm a former constitutional law professor and tow truck driver. Not necessarily in that order. Craig Bellis. As per our usual practice, let's take a moment and check in with everybody and see what interesting or good things you experienced this last week. Let me start out with you, Amy. Have you checked your calendar to know what you've been doing the last week?
I did. I did check my calendar. I think I was recovering last week. That's what I decided, is recovering from our absolute fun fest at Raise the Roof for Vashon Household, and looking forward to our community forum tomorrow night with all of our legislators. We've got Emily Alvarado and Brianna Thomas and Joe Fitzgibbon coming to the VCA for a free community forum. Talk about what's going on in the legislature for Vashon, and come on down and ask your questions about what the state legislature can do for you or has done for you. Most recently, it has expanded our water taxi to Saturdays. That is what our state legislator, Emily Alvarado, really worked on all year. It took her almost a year to secure that funding, but that's what's possible. So come on down and see what else we can do as a community.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And just to put a exclamation point at the end of that, this is all, although it's put on by Islanders for Fairy Action, mm-hmm. it is not just a fairy gathering.
All issues on the table, 6 o'clock VCA.
Right.
Tomorrow night.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Bruce, how about you?
Well, it's been a great sort of end of summer, beginning of fall kind of week. We had that incredible overnight rain over the weekend. And it's sort of, that's what I love about the Northwest right now. When it rains at night, but it's kind of sunny and warm during
it's
the day.
Camelot. Mm-hmm. Camelot.
It is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and of course, this weekend with the M's, you know, pulling a sweep.
Yeah,
in
that was
Houston,
good.
It's sort of like, what is going on? I mean, they are hitting their stride just at the right time. Yeah. And then the Seahawks, I mean, 21 points in the first 4 minutes or 5 minutes of the game is sort of like, what is this team and where do they come from? Yeah. So pretty exciting weekend in that sense. And then, of course, the Huskies, you know, sort of winning the Apple Cup.
I hardly call that a win. Well, that was just a rout.
Just sort of like, oh, man, oh, well. Yeah, I'm always disappointed with college football. The first 3 or 4 weeks, they set up these, you know, Ohio State against Grambling kind of things. So it's sort of like, come on, let's get serious here. But that's good. And then this morning we ran the crab boat around from KVI back into Quartermaster Harbor, and it was just a glorious morning out there. I mean, just flat calm. Sunrise, you know, it was just incredible out there. And so you just grab these end of summer days and just feel like, man, you can feel them slipping away. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, man, what a way to end an incredible summer.
Mm-hmm. You were out there on the water rather than watching the president's address to the United Nations Assembly?
Who?
This morning?
Yes.
They had to sit through that?
Oh.
Haven't we done enough to the world?
I sat through it just so I don't know, because I'm a masochist.
Masochist, I was going to say, guys.
Let me tell you, the water was much more enjoyable.
Yeah, sure. Kevin.
Yeah, I'm here. Hey, I'm thinking that UN speech is plenty of material for the Onion to be working with.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Oh, yeah, so we'll see how that comes out. Hey, it's been 2 weeks since I've been on board here, so I survived the passport to pain. Year two. Had a buddy from Olympia come up. He didn't register in time to get the official number assignments, because they give you the lower number the older you are. Mm. And I think he at 82 would have been the oldest in the event if and gotten number one. But next year, all you need to do it. Also out boating, we saw yesterday we think a flock of spotted sandpipers. Mm. And we've been seeing the geese also forming up in their V's, you know, ready to head south. So it's like Bruce says, you know, it's that type of changing season. But I'm also looking ahead. And on the 30th, just a week from today, 7 p.m., Vashon High School Theater. If y'all remember Dr. Larry Hubble talking about the public sector heroes, the first one of those, September 30th, Tuesday, 7 p.m., Vashon High School Theater, John Lewis will be featured. And then just for those who are marking their calendars on the 8th of October, Indivisible Vashon's membership meeting, they're going to let me host a meeting.
Right.
So, yeah, show up and check, you know, give me some, you know, you can give me some score points on how that goes. So, yeah, come on down. And it's at the Vashon United Methodist Church, 7 p.m., 8th of October. Should be very interesting.
I'm sure it'll be a very friendly audience. Nobody's going to be throwing vegetables or anything.
No. We have not seen any vegetables other than what we put out, you know, for food.
That's right.
Maybe some extra zucchini.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Don't leave your car unlocked.
That's right. Yeah. Don't leave your car unlocked. Yeah. Exactly. Alex, how about you?
I've been working here and there. I've been taking afternoon walks on the beach, plucking fruit from various trees. Sanding furniture and oiling furniture, and doing a lot of reading and otherwise enjoying myself.
You hear sounds that relaxed?
You hear that relaxed?
I was going to say his voice. It sounds so meditative.
Yeah, indeed.
And, you know,
I love
contemplative.
It. Contemplative. Indeed.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Well, we'll try to shake it up a little bit.
You'll get the terror back into it.
Okay.
Soon,
so. I had a great week. Truman, what happened to you?
I don't know.
Oh, there you are, right there.
What did happen?
My apologies.
That's quite all right.
Truman, well, how was your week?
Why, thanks for asking.
Well, that's enough.
Well, you know, last week on the Brown Briefly, we had three of the principals from the Vashon Opera. And I have to tell you, I'm really, really proud of the Vashon Opera. They have just knocked it out of the park this year in particular. This is their fantasy season. And this one was Cinderella, which we talked about, and I had the opportunity to go on Friday night, and I'm telling you, it was fantastic. These the principals that we had, Sarah and Grace and Andy, were just amazing. And we talked about Grace doing a trouser role where she played Prince Charming. Well, she's 6'1", I think, or 6'2". Mm-hmm. I think she's 6'2", and she's a very tall woman. And she played the part absolutely brilliantly, and she's sitting on this sofa, and you're watching, and you know, okay, yeah, that's Prince Charming, and da da da. And then she stands up and she opens her mouth, and you go, because she has got this incredible mezzo soprano voice, just beautiful. But anyway, the sets, the everything about it was just fantastic. At one point, they have the chorus coming from the back of the theater. And it just was magical. It really was. It was just fantastic. Anyway, enough about that. I had the opportunity on Sunday to go over to Port Orchard, where my niece's son just turned 21. They had a little party for him. And I walked in. I haven't seen him. He was up in Alaska all summer. So he's grown a beard and got his mustache going. And I hadn't seen him in quite a while. I walked in and I said, oh, my gosh, it's Cal Raleigh. I mean, he looks exactly like Cal Raleigh, I'm telling you. And, of course, a couple of people said, who? I said, come on. You don't know who that is, you know. But anyway, really a nice young man and a fun party. So
He does look just like Cal Raleigh.
Yeah, he showed me the picture.
You showed me the picture, yeah.
I
know. And the opera, you know, a lot of people I mentioned, I didn't get to go. I had other things that I just really wanted to go because it is a wonderful family, and the Vashon Opera is great.
Yeah.
But I mention the opera to people, and they go, opera. I said, give it a chance.
Yeah.
You should go to one of the Vashon. If you're going to be introduced to opera, you don't have to go to, you know, the Benaroya into the city. You can go right down the street here.
Yeah.
You may be very surprised. I've heard a lot of people come out of those and go, oh, my, I didn't realize how enjoyable that was.
Just fantastic.
It's a good group. It's really a good group. And rotating stars, you will.
And I have to tell you, I saw Jennifer Krikowa, who's the founder of the opera. She was attending and sitting just one row behind me. And during intermission, I said, you must be very proud. And she said, oh, I am. She said, they're just doing a fabulous job.
They are. There was one defect in the
production. Yeah, you weren't there.
There was no troll.
That's right. That's right. They did talk about that.
All right. Is it my turn now?
It is.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
My apologies to you.
Let's go ahead.
No, I had a great week. My our son, Nick, came up from Ashland, Oregon for the day, and we toured around the island, did the walk out at Docton, read all of the historic signs that are out there, went by the museum, and I hadn't been to the museum for a few months. Oh, the museum is terrific. Bruce, I got to tell you, the work that you did and everybody there to get that museum in the shape it's in, it is a remarkable little museum that covers so much of Vashon's history. It's incredible. Bravo.
You could easily spend several hours there.
You could spend actually a couple of days there.
It's like going to the Smithsonian. You know, there's no way you can see everything. In fact, I compared it to the Smithsonian. It's got that feel to it. It really does. Yeah. Well, it's amazing.
It's great. And then on Saturday, CERT, the Community Emergency Response Team, did an earthquake exercise all day. And which was timely in light of what happened in the Bay Area yesterday morning, the earthquake that they had down there in Berkeley and that area. But it was an excellent exercise. We worked with the medical corps and the fire department and the emergency operations center and trying to get our act together and figure out where the holes are in communication and how we can speed up the process. And I think we all learned a great deal. And by the way, if anybody is interested in becoming a member of CERT, this is a good time to go online and look up Vashon CERT and maybe go to one of the introductory classes that they have to teach you some of the things that the CERT members are trained to become proficient at. Yes.
I just wanted to tell you, I forgot. I got to attend as an observer the Medical Reserve Corps exercise, and from the beginning. And the reason I was going is obviously I've told you we're working on doing an aviation CERT kind of a organization. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to see, and I'm telling you, I'm very pleased with our procedure that we've got because it matched pretty much what MRC was doing in their process. But it looked like organized chaos to start, but it very, very soon gelled into really a very efficient thing. Anyway, I was very appreciative of them allowing us to do that.
Yeah, I was part of there's a MERT team, the Marine Emergency Response Team. We headquarters out of a yacht club and sent boats out to Outer Quartermaster Harbor, make contact with communities that might have been isolated, delivered medicine, delivered supplies. And you do those exercises because all the things you screw up, sort of like, we need to make sure we do this and that and whatever. But it was very effective,
Well, one of the things that fascinated me, we were in the triage area, and Lauren Chase, who's going to be our new airport commissioner after November, she and I attended as observers. And during triage, about the third patient that came in, they said, this is a transport for dialysis off island. They handed it to me. They said, this is you guys. I went, no, we're just observers. But it brought down to, hey, that's the kind of thing that our aviation unit can do, is to take those people that need those kinds of services. So,
And it can be, the whole thing is fun. I mean, it's fun in the exercises. I'm sure it's not fun in reality, But a few years ago, we had a couple Blackhawk helicopters come to the island, and we were training to get people wrapped up and moved onto those helicopters with those blades spinning right above our heads. That's right. Keep your head down. We learned to keep our heads down, that's for sure. You've been in and out of a helicopter, too.
Oh, a couple of times.
All right. Enough tomfoolery. September 23rd is a significant day, as are all days. It's 38 days until one of my favorite holidays on Vashon, Halloween, on October 31st. A great day. And also the day of the Day of the Dead, which is another one of my favorite holidays. 93 days until Christmas, and 406 days until the midterm elections on November 3rd, 2026. But who's counting?
Who's counting?
And on this day in history, in 1642.
Also, wait, Kevin.
Oh, is that Kevin there? Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
But also, this November 3rd, there are elections as well.
That's right.
Yes, right here in Washington State, right across Colville's Passage, is our favorite, Deborah Krishnadasan, in the 26th Legislative District. That seat that we barely flipped to Emily Randall, who's now in Congress. So go check out indivisiblevashon.org and go to Get Out the Vote page, and you can find out how to help. We're going to be canvassing, actually, there on Thursday. So, right on, this November.
And I'm running for re-election on November 5th. Myself.
You have a lot of people running against
you.
Yeah,
I'm worried about the write-ins, actually, but no.
There's a number of local elections on Vashon, the healthcare district, fire district. Yeah. A lot of, to your point, I'm not sure many of the races are particularly challenged, but there are a few that are, and it's people discount local elections, and they really shouldn't.
So. That's right. Should vote for any chance you get. Bring back democracy in America. Yeah. One vote at a time.
Yeah.
On this day in history, in 1642, Harvard College, as they call it, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had its first commencement ceremony. In 1806, Lewis and Clark returned from their trip to the Pacific Northwest, nearly 2.5 years, having left St. Louis in May of 1804.
Wow.
Yeah, that was... Quite the adventure.
And it only takes about 4 hours to do that now.
Yeah, yeah. Depending on your vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your equipment. In 1845, the first baseball team, I always love the name of the New York Knickerbockers, organized and adopted a rule book known as the Knickerbocker Rules. So, in 1889... Not 1989. In 1889, Nintendo was formed.
What were they doing in 1889?
Playing cards.
Oh, I'll be darned.
A game involving cards, not poker. Not poker cards.
But, I'll be darned.
Yeah, they've been around a long time. In 1926, there was the upset of the decade. Gene Tunney beats defending world heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey by 10-round unanimous decision in Philadelphia. I have a little boxing glove, a tiny little boxing glove that I went up and I gave to Jack Dempsey in his restaurant in New York, and he signed it, and I still have that little boxing glove.
Oh, cool.
Jack Dempsey lived to 1980-something.
Wow.
So, and finally, unfortunately, in 1969, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid premiered in New Haven, Connecticut, of course, with Paul Newman and Robert Redford, who left us this week.
Yeah.
Wow. Or last week.
Yeah,
what day was that? Can't remember now. Last week. Yeah.
Today
is also Redhead Appreciation Day. That's when they have the big giant gathering in Ireland with all of the redheads. And International Voter Registration Day, which is very appropriate, especially after today's unhinged UN speech. But that's my own editorial. all right. Now, finally, Alex, we're going to get to you and learn about what's going on with you. And I welcome and thank you for returning. You've been here a few times before in a capacity of editor of the Beachcomber. Now you've exited that role, and we hope you feel even less constrained in talking about Vashon and the nation. I was going to just start out. We've done this before, but... Some people who may not know anything about you other than you were the editor of the Beachcomber, give us a quick perspective on how you ended up on Vashon, how long you worked as editor, and what you're up to now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm 30. I graduated the University of Washington in 2018 and went to working in daily and weekly newspapers around Western Washington. I worked in Longview for a few years. I moved up back to King County during the pandemic. That's when I joined up with Sound Publishing, which is the parent company of the Beachcomber. So I worked at the Enumclaw newspaper owned by that company. I worked in Federal Way. And then in 23, late 23, is when they asked me if I wanted to take on a role as the editor of the Beachcomber. People might recall that was, at that time, Liz Shepard was the sole newsroom employee, and so they were really looking for someone to kind of step in and add a little bit more firepower. So I accepted, and I joined in that fall, and I ended up being at the Beachcomber for almost exactly 2 years. I think I was about a week off, or I think a week over. So 2 years and a week. I left last month. It's been about a month now since I've been gone. And I think I'm breaking news here, but they just yesterday was the first day of work for Aspen Anderson, who's a former freelancer who worked with me. She was a Vashon High School graduate, fantastic reporter. She's their new reporter, and my understanding is that she's going to, similarly to me, spend a few months working up until she's ready to take on the role as editor.
Wow.
Part of my There were many reasons that went into why I left, and I'll try to kind of hit all of them, but part of it was timing. I had known that I had wanted to leave for quite a while. I kind of knew about 7 months in that, you know, it was going to be time for me to leave once the opportunity presented itself. And I realized when I knew that Aspen would be completing her internship at the LA Times this summer, that an opportunity would present itself to get someone really, really smart, really energetic, really enthusiastic into the Beachcomber, and that I could time it so that I would leave about a few weeks before she would become available. So I wanted to sort of create that opportunity and you know, basically give the paper the chance to snatch her up before someone else did, if she wanted to, you know, be snatched up, and she did. And so I'm really happy to see that. I have complete faith in her. I think she's already a better journalist than I am. I think she's got just killer instincts.
Before you move on,
please. Yeah.
One, if she's a better news person,
she's going to be amazing.
I was going to say than you are.
Yeah.
That's saying something, because I thought you did a great job.
I agree. 100%.
In the 2 years that you worked your butt off. It really quite extraordinary. And we send our best wishes and luck to Aston Anderson, and look forward to her moving into that role. That you did break that news. That was totally news to me. So thank you.
It's been in the works. I just wanted to wait until all the I's were dotted and T's crossed. As for why, and I'll just kind of give you a real quick sketch of why I left. I don't think it's anything surprising to anyone. It was an extraordinarily stressful job for me. I was not particularly happy. I think it was work I really got fulfillment out of. But I've sort of had a, I guess I would say, on again, off again, love, exasperation affair with journalism since I've been in it. Like I said, there's parts of it that are deeply meaningful and fulfilling, but broadly, I think the way my brain works is that I'm too frustrated by the things I can't do. I'm stressed out by the stories I can't get to. This coincided with my diagnosis of attention deficit disorder a month ago. So a few things kind of crystallized. And I have a friend who said that there's this thing that happens to you around 28 to 31 where you just sort of like things start kind of clicking a little bit. And that's what has been happening for me. I realized that I'm a great person. There's many things I'm great at. This job is not something that I can do long term, and I needed to try something else. So that's what I decided to do. And so at the moment, I am doing a lot of different things. I'm taking a lot of the pieces that I developed at the newspaper and now doing them sort of independently. So I am doing photography, headshots, portraits. I'm gearing up to do graduation photos, family portraits for Christmas cards, that kind of thing. You can learn more at alexburwell.com if you're interested. I'm editing a friend's book for him. There's a local fiction author, soon-to-be author on the island. I'm helping him get some of his work published. I'm restoring wood furniture for a person I know. Just a lot of little different things. My hope and sort of my medium-term plan at this point is to pull together some part-time work that will just kind of be a foundation, just kind of financially, to sort of have a really stable source of income. But I think my calling at this moment in my life is to pursue more of my creative independent development, especially knowing just my neurodivergency and knowing how my kind of work looks like and what works best for me.
You know, I have to tell you, you said 28 to 31. Mm-hmm. 32, I decided that all I ever really wanted to do was fly airplanes. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got my first job as a pilot at age 32. But you're right about that. It's exactly when that kind of comes together, when you go, what am I doing? You know, I really need to pursue my dream. And that was it for me. So, you know, you mentioned working at other newspapers. And so how did working here differ? I mean, was there, I know you're in a different position here, but did you find that there's quite a bit of difference in the way that the news was gathered and reported here from other places? Or what kinds of challenges did you find there?
I think the Beachcomber was the best place I ever worked and the most challenging. And I think that's partly just the role. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this paper had the highest expectations of any paper I've worked at. In fact, I won't even say I think I know that for a fact. You had a readership that was more plugged in, that was more attuned to when we made errors, and I really appreciated that. The response that I got from the public was always incredibly positive. Now, I've said this, I've kind of told people this before. Contextually, I came from working in very conservative rural communities during Trump's first administration when I got out of college. So I was used to, you know, threats and people not wanting to talk to you and, you know, going up to knock on someone's door and wondering, am I going to get
shot?
Well, yeah, as a guy, you know, I mean, there was a lot of like tactical kind of safety things. And, and which is not to, I love those communities, I love the people in them. I don't mean to denigrate them, but there was a culture war that existed there that I was on the wrong side of, that sort of the other side of it. So the tension was, you know, non-existent here in that sense. How the paper differed, you know, I came from working a lot of papers that had a lot of wire content. So the AP Wire, for those who don't know, it's a service where, you know, if you read the Seattle Times, you have some local stories, but you'll also have national news and you'll have kind of a blend. I always loved working at the Beachcomber because we didn't do that and everything was local. And even if it meant we put a story on the front page about, you know, some organization getting a $20,000 check, you know, that's front page news. That's a big deal. Yeah. I didn't want to spend my time regurgitating whatever national news was happening or even state news. I always wanted to really focus locally because I thought that's what people come to us for. There's no lack of places to get news about Donald Trump or anyone else. And, you know, for most people, so you don't need, that's not what people come to us for. We try as much as we can to keep that on the opinion page.
You know, we talked about this at length at the Brown briefly, that we're not going to be CNN or MSNBC. We're local. And the only time when this does become significant for what's happening in the national or international news is how it affects us and how it affects our relationships and those sorts of things. So I think that is important that we can bring those to the table, but to concentrate on local.
Yeah,
we agree.
That's how I always put it was, you know, we'll write about this, but what is the local connection?
Exactly.
What is the thing that's making it a live issue for people in Vashon, as opposed to there's a million things we could write about any day, but do people here care about it to
read
in the paper?
Yeah.
Thank you. Let me follow up with that a little bit, Alex, in terms of, you know, I mean, a local weekly newspaper has a unique situation in a community, as you've expressed already. Tell us a little bit, and for the listeners, about, I mean, what does it take to make a small local weekly paper work? I mean, what are the components that go into it? What kind of support do you get from the community in terms of subscriptions, in terms of advertising? You know, I mean, all those sort of pieces that you as an editor had to sort of juggle with Daryl and as a publisher to make sure that each week you had an issue coming out.
Yeah. One of my hobbies when I am traveling across the state or anywhere in the country is I pick up, anytime I'm in a small town, I always pick up their newspaper. And I just try to see how are they doing it? What because I think every community is different. Every community has different advantages and different people that help you put something out. And so I'm always curious, what is the juice or what's the spark that they have that's keeping them along? Because it is, I think that's, there's always sort of an existential thought whenever you're working in local news, because, you know, in the last 20 years, more than something like half of newspapers have shuttered. So yeah. The closeness of death is in your mind, not that it's imminent, but yet you're always thinking like we operate in some ways on a razor's edge. So for Vashon, I would say the paper, I would sometimes say the paper really punched above its weight. And I attribute that to the really primarily just the quality of contributors that we had. We've, like yourself, Bruce, as I guess my first example, but we have an incredible roster of people. I still say we, old habits die hard. But the paper has an incredible roster of people who just contribute a lot of stuff for free, who write sports articles, your history columns. That is how we fill the page with material that otherwise there's just not enough time for 1.5 FTE news staff to cover. Right. So I think if you didn't have that, if you didn't have a community support, you would see a much more sickly kind of flailing beachcomber. That's probably the big thing. And then otherwise, it takes just a lot of hard work. It takes a community that sort of, if there's an interplay. I mean, if people are aware of the beachcomber and have a level of trust that we have to earn, then they're going to tell us when something's happening and we're going to get alerted to a story and we'll go out and cover it. Whereas if that trust isn't there, then it doesn't get covered and then it looks kind of weaker and it's a downward spiral. I guess an example is I still read the paper, obviously, and I just last week, I think there was coverage of a Charlie Kirk vigil at Ober Park.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's having covered many, many protests early in my career, or not necessarily protests, but events of a conservative persuasion, I'm used to walking into those situations and sort of having to tell everyone, hey guys, here I am, would love to talk to you. I understand if you're a little anxious about talking to me, it's reasonable for you to feel that way, but here's, you know, just, I mean, there's a sort of breaking the ice. And in the story that Liz wrote, she mentioned in it that she was alerted to it 20 minutes before it was going to happen. Someone in the group said, hey, we should call the beachcomber. And that to me is a sign that, you know, yes, this is a progressive, you know, liberal / left leaning island. It's a really good sign when the conservative, when people who are, mourning a conservative figure feel comfortable calling the newspaper to report on it, that there's a level of trust that, you know, we don't hide our politics. I didn't hide my politics when I was there, but I try to treat people fairly and I try to reflect the world honestly. If you don't have that level of trust, and I've worked at places where I didn't, like I said, it's a downward spiral, because then you miss out on opportunities to earn that trust, to report stories that are thoughtful and fair. That proves to people that you didn't deserve it, and hence it goes down and down the spiral.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of curious, just to kind of zoom up to, you know, journalism and the state of the fourth estate in general, right, is pretty sad, I think, in the United States when you look at national news and just kind of it does feel like the chilling effect has taken effect. Just kind of curious your thoughts on, you know, what do you see in journalism up on a larger scale, you know, these days, and how it compares to, you know, the work that you're doing or the work that, you know, your colleagues do, right, on a local level. What's missing? Why is the fourth estate falling down so hard in our very, very quick right turn to where we're going?
Yeah, that's a very big question. So I'll take a few angles on it. I think just culturally in general, the cultural pendulum in this country has swung to the right in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years. And so newspapers and media and journalism are not, they're not like some, they're not immune to the forces of cultural physics. They're not stuck outside of these things. I think if you look at any society, the news has always been made by people, and people are susceptible to whatever the political winds are. So, you know, it's a money make for most news operations. It's a money making operation, and you make decisions subconsciously or consciously to survive as an organization, and you balance those with your ethics. So that's like a very theoretical explanation. And then I, you know, the industry has been changing so much in the last 30 years, as people know, the you know, the way, I mean, just really broadly, the profit has gone out of print and has gone into, you know, companies that can advertise much more powerfully online. So all the ways that these, you know, places used to be able to make money are drying up. In their place, you're seeing, I think, a proliferation of more independent, more kind of personality-driven news, which has its drawbacks, but then you get really fantastic reporting by people like Ken Klippenstein, who does, you know, national security reporting that I think often goes beyond what CNN or the New York Times are doing. So it's a broader, more diverse ecosystem. It's more diffuse. You're seeing the power players, the old kind of news institutions, I think very slowly are losing that power, and I think we're in a time of transition. And I think when you take a time of transition and you combine it with a toxic sort of proto-fascist conservative administration, you have a recipe for destabilized decision-making at these news outlets, because there's just so much on the line, there's so much in flux, there's so much risk.
And, you know, one of the things we've talked about it at length is the changing way that people receive their news. I mean, we're talking about social media and all of these things. How do you see the print paper in particular navigating those changes? I mean, do you see a way forward for that?
Not in its current state. No, I mean, I would be very surprised if a paper like The Beachcomber still has a print product in 15 years. That, I mean, it'd be impressive. I mean, it's in just basic economics, you know, younger people are less interested in reading print. We're also becoming a more kind of globally connected culture. The things that we care and talk about tend to be more national, global issues. And at the expense of, I think, we're less locally connected to each other. That has an impact on local news, because if you are not as compelled by local goings on, you're probably not as likely to read your local newspaper. Which is not to say that young people don't, but I think that's a factor. So I suspect that newspapers will continue to shutter or to go online only. I think anyone who runs newspapers, there's a clock ticking. They know that at some point they're not going to be printing newsprint anymore. It's going to be a digital only operation. I think you'll still see, I think you'll maybe see papers going from dailies to weeklies or weeklies to monthlies. You can still put out a product and get a lot of advertising and make money from it. But, you know, having the costs and the you know, but the printing costs and the personnel costs to put out a print newspaper is just kind of dicey now. So I think print editions will become more of a luxury, or like kind of an interesting, unique product. You know, the paper does Destination Vashon, which is a sort of a guide for people. That's sort of, I almost see that kind of becoming a direction that I think more money is put into, where it's really a specialty product. It's something that people want to collect or give out. And it's easier to sell that as something that sticks around for a while, as opposed to a daily print paper, which just doesn't have a lot of longevity.
Well, if you go to a weekly or a monthly, you're going to get rid of the news now stuff, and it's going to be more what's long term or opinion pieces, you know, editorial stuff. I would think anyway.
Absolutely, and that's that I think is the digital first transition. People are just going to go to online for news.
Kevin, before I go to you, this discussion kind of reminds me of an issue I see all the time now, and I'm a little concerned about it. People, and I don't want to put people in two different camps with regards to how they get their news, but you have a lot of people who get their news that's directed toward their personal opinions. Substack, for example, is a something that I look at all the time because I like the people that submit information to Substack, and it's a progressive, typically, group more than anything else. But then there's this whole other group of news people that that claim that all they're doing is delivering the facts without an opinion. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of it. 1409
or something. 1440.
1440, right. And I've looked at that and I've always thought, how do you do that? Because how do you give the bottom line mm-hmm. without that being an opinion?
Well, that's a fallacy, right? Yeah, right.
Yeah, so when I talk to people about news bias, I think people focus way too much on obvious things that like bias that is like really easy to point out, like reporting where, you know, opinion is freely, you know, a statement of opinion is freely mixed in. Like someone reporting on Trump says, you know, the administration did X, Y, Z, and that's really bad and wrong. Hmm. I think people focus on that and say, well, that's the kind of bias we should remove from news. It's actually very easy to remove that bias and to have a news organization that superficially presents as objective. The bias that I think is more concerning and that is basically impossible to ever get rid of is, you know, the decision-making factor. And as someone who's worked in journalism for 10 years, I can tell you, you can never have truly factual, truly unbiased journalism. I don't think it's possible to live in the world in that kind of way, because your perspective and your tendencies inform what kind of stories you write about, what kind of people you interview, what kind of questions you are afraid to ask them, or what kind of questions you ask them that you maybe wouldn't ask a different kind of person. There's a million invisible decisions that go into every article that are subtly shaped by your ideology.
It's your filter that you have.
Exactly.
You filter the stuff that comes in.
And that's has vastly more of an effect than, you know, the sort of more obvious. Again, I think anyone who says that, well, I'm the one giving unbiased mm-hmm. information, my tendency when I hear that is to think this is probably someone who is going to give me extraordinarily, but I mean, everyone is going to give me biased information. Yeah. The problem is this person wants me to think that their bias isn't, you know, an honest newspaper person says, look, this is where I'm coming from. Yep. And you should read widely. And if you think I'm wrong on this, read another person who disagrees with me.
Plus, if you have two opinions, there's this, you know, we have to give them equal time. We've got to treat them both the same. When any objective observation would say that some one side's opinion in certain areas, and I'm not talking about Democrats versus Republicans, is absurd, mm-hmm. and you're going to treat that as if it was equal to mm-hmm. you know some other facts or opinions.
I mean, British newspapers for 100 years have sort of dealt with that. You know, they make no pretense about whether they're liberal or conservative. And, you know, if you're going to read The Guardian, you're going to get a liberal point of view. If you're going to read The London Times, you're going to get a conservative point of view. And they don't even pretend to be, you know, unbiased in that sense or sort of not lean one way or the other. You know, American journalism has always tried to present itself as this sort of unbiased sort of, and it never has been.
It's a pretension, I think. Right. Yeah.
Kevin, were you waiting there in the wings on Zoom?
Well, I'd also like to weigh in on this thing, because as you're talking about bias and facts-only news reporting, I think, you know, facts without context are really kind of abstractions. Hmm. And I don't know, Alex, if you want to comment on that, Alex, but it seems like you always have to set a context for the cradle, if you will, that carries the facts to the readers. And that context is also a opportunity for bias to be portrayed in the news reporting. So,
yeah, anyway. You can lead someone to any opinion if you present the right facts in the right order and omit facts that are inconvenient. And that is how bias and how propaganda actually happens. It's typically sophisticated, you know, social engineering through media is presented in a way that seems factual and objective. It's not presented as an opinion, and that's why it's, I think, basically impossible to ever have a fully neutral context.
Yeah, the one example I always have to go back to is, do you remember when they were throwing rocks across the border and they got tear gassed? if you listen to one group, Fox in particular, what you heard about was how dangerous those rocks being thrown were and to endangering the lives of the, and they were only protecting themselves. If you hear from the other side, those poor Mexicans were tear gassed and they had their children there and everything, and they don't say anything about the rocks. But it's the exact same event, but from two totally different viewpoints. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
No worries. Well, maybe to bring back to sort of local, your tenure on the Beachcomber, I'm actually going to throw three questions at you, Alex. So one, just generally, what was your most memorable or maybe a most impactful story that you wrote? I'm curious if you had like a funny favorite story. Mm-hmm. And just to set the stage for, you know, for the your folks coming up, Aspen and others, Liz, et cetera, what's the one unwritten story that you most want to see written?
Only one. I had dozens and dozens. You should have seen the to-do list I gave them when I left. I mean, it went on and on. So I think the most important story I wrote here was my very long explainer on the zoning situation at the Seattle Indian Health Board's future Thunderbird Treatment Center. And that was a situation that was one of the most complicated stories I've ever written. It required hours on the phone with people at King County, you know, records requests of hundreds of documents. And I learned a lot from it, and it sort of confirmed so many things about journalism that I've come to realize, which is in any situation where there's not a lot of information about something or where there's confusion about something, everyone will develop their own theory about what is going on. And I think the greatest and highest calling of a journalist is to go in and say, I don't care. I'm not going to tell you what to think about this thing. My purpose here is not to proffer an opinion about what should or shouldn't happen. It's just to clear the air, to explain what is and isn't true, and to let that be a foundation. You know, I always think of my articles as let what I write be a foundation for everyone to have their debates on. Yeah. But I don't want to be involved in the debate itself. So yeah. I'm taking a break on this thing after this. Like, you guys have to figure, like, I can't solve this war for you people. You've got to take it from here for me.
But that's not your job. Your job is to
set a lot of people seem to think it's my job.
Yeah.
But I didn't see, I saw my position as, you know, just coming in and clearing the air. And that was all I wanted to do. I think as far as fun or funny, I really enjoyed going out with the Vashon Nature Center to pick up the bones of the gray whale that washed up. I took my camera with me and just got some incredible and really fun photos of people. You know, you have a vertebra, like one spinal bone that's the size of a truck tire, and it weighs 30 pounds. And so people just hauling these bones, that was really cool. I really enjoyed, as far as like maybe funny, I did a fun piece about the Granny's Attic After Dark sale last year.
Yeah.
And I mean, you live for that stuff when you're a journalist because the quotes you get are just outstanding. So those were both great. And then your question was about sort of looking ahead, what stories do I see as important for the paper? You know, let me pull up the spreadsheet here that I still have access to while I'm talking. But I think the obvious things, I mean, there's conversations around cost of living and, you know, access to healthcare on this island that are ongoing that have been important conversations and will continue to be for probably many years to come. I really, really want to see the paper do a story about mental health, substance abuse. You know, there were many stories that I had started working there where there was a police response to a violent incident, and there was such a beautiful, deep story behind it and such a heartbreaking story about the way that our law enforcement and mental health system, you know, people fall through the gaps. So I really wanted to see that. I think there's some self-examination, you know, about some of that needs to happen on Vashon. Those are the big ones, I would say. And then, yeah, like I said, housing and healthcare, I mean, are just always going to be perennially important issues out here.
We've only got a few minutes left. Truman, did you have a quick question?
Well, yeah, I was just, so, you know, you we kind of, unless you do an editorial, we don't really get to know your opinion on something. So how about the greatest challenges coming up? What are some of the greatest attributes of living here and some of the challenges of living here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really beautiful community. And I think, like I've said a few times, incredibly supportive. I think people here care a lot and they're connected and they want to help people. And so I think that's really a source of power that can be tapped into and should be. It's still really expensive to live out here. Mm-hmm. I mean, Amy, I don't need to tell you that, you know, it's difficult for people to, especially if you want things done, if you want people to have jobs and to build things and to bag groceries, you need to figure out where you're going to put them. Mm-hmm. And that's going to continue to be a problem as long as, you know, the nature of real estate and housing on this island is the way it is. I think healthcare especially will continue to be, I mean, since I got here, the last 2 years, healthcare has really flowered. And there's so many options now that there weren't before, mm-hmm. but there's still so much room to grow and expand. I would love to see some more capacity for, brick and mortar urgent care. And I don't know if we'll ever have a hospital out here, but some kind of ability to just treat. I mean, CMAR is, you know, overloaded. They've got a new clinic coming up. I hope it helps them, you know, handle the amount of patients they have.
Emergency room would be great.
It's a question of, can the population justify it? Exactly. And I don't think it can now, but it would be nice. I mean, it would really be great.
I agree.
Bruce, did you want to open up a new subject in the last few minutes here?
Yeah, we got a minute for you to talk about about the future of, you know, the free speech in the United States. I mean, as a newspaper person in a small community, a supportive community, you've had less to confront on that basis. But what do you see happening in a larger community, nationally, internationally? You know, I mean, you've been around the block a few times. So what are you concerned about?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously we are living under an authoritarian, disturbing White House. And I would describe it as sort of proto-fascist. And we're living in a cultural climate where, political violence is being normalized, and it's sort of every day it seems we're sort of getting further and further away from the idea of getting along and getting things done. I think that's concerning to most people. If I had the answer to how to fix that, I guess I would try to go to Washington, D.C. I'm very concerned about Trump, obviously, as I think we all are.
Sure. You know, Alex, I always kind of wondered about your feelings on subjects like that, although you're right. You did not hide your bent, if you will, while you were writing. People knew where you stood, and you were a great editor. There's no question about it. I don't know if you had any final thoughts that we missed that you wanted to mention.
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I guess just on the national scene, I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you see news organizations and broadcasters and publishers being put in sort of very tenuous situations where they're being asked to pull people off the air, they're being threatened by the FCC. I hope that these organizations who have some power and connection to the public decide to not kiss the ring. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, I think that's the most important thing you can do when you have a power-hungry tyrant is to not give him what he wants, because he will have a habit of wanting more after you've given him that. And it's a easy slope into, you know, a much darker version of this country. So I think that's maybe an attitude we can all carry forward, is just don't comply in advance. You know, if you're put in that situation, you'll decide what to do then, but fight it out and have the battle before you give up.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you very, very much for being here. Bruce, next week?
If you love maps, you know, tune in next week. We're going to have cartographer Stefan Freeland. Many of you may have seen the map that he developed as a Salish Sea.
Yeah.
You know, he was instrumental in putting that together. And he's done the most recent Vashon Road map. So if you're a map lover, tune in next week.
Excellent.
Right. And don't forget, this Wednesday, September 24th, from 5:30 to 7 at the VCA, there's a community forum with our state legislators. It's free. We're going to be talking about all kinds of issues, so drop on by for that. And I'll finish off with, for Alex, Amy, Kevin, Bruce, Truman, and me, Craig Bellis, thank you very much for joining the Brown Briefly. Until the Briefly's return next Tuesday morning at 11, please enjoy autumn in the Northwest.